time, his opening line was this one. America is the wealthiest nation on earth, but its people are mainly poor, and poor Americans are urged to hate themselves. To quote the American humorist Kin Hubbard, "It ain't no disgrace to be poor, but it might as well be." It is in fact a crime for an American to be poor, even though America is a nation of poor. Every other nation has folk traditions of men who were poor but extremely wise and virtuous, and therefore more estimable than anyone with power and gold. No such tales are told by the American poor. They mock themselves and glorify their betters. The meanest eating or drinking establishment, owned by a man who is himself poor, is very likely to have a sign on its wall asking this cruel question, "If you're so smart, why ain't you rich?" There will also be an American flag no larger than a child's hand, glued to a lollipop stick and flying from the cash register. The author of the monograph, a native of Schenectady, New York, was said by some to have the highest IQ of all the war criminals who were made to face a death by hanging. So it goes. Americans, like human beings everywhere, believe many things that are obviously untrue, the monograph went on. Their most destructive untruth is that it is very easy for any American to make money. They will not acknowledge how, in fact, hard money is to come by, and therefore, those who have no money blame and blame and blame themselves. This inward blame has been a treasure for the rich and powerful, who have had to do less for their poor, publicly and privately, than any other ruling class since, say, Napoleonic times. Many novelties have come from America. The most startling of these, a thing without precedent, is a mass of undignified poor. They do not love one another because they do not love themselves. Once this is understood, the disagreeable behavior of American enlisted men in German prisons ceases to be a mystery. Howard W. Campbell, Jr. now discussed the uniform of the American enlisted in World War II. Every other army in history, prosperous or not, has attempted to clothe even its lowliest soldiers so as to make them impressive to themselves and others as stylish experts in drinking and copulation and looting and sudden death. The American Army, however, sends its enlisted men out to fight and die in a modified business suit quite evidently made for another man, a sterilized but unpressed gift from a nose-holding charity which passes out clothing to drunks in the slums. When a dashingly clad officer addresses such a frumpishly dressed bum, he scolds him, as an officer in any army must. But the officer's contempt is not, as in other armies, avuncular theatricality. It is a genuine expression of hatred for the poor, who have no one to blame for their misery but themselves. A prison administrator dealing with captured American enlisted men for the first time should be warned, "Expect no brotherly love, even between brothers. There will be no cohesion between the individuals. Each will be a sulky child who often wishes he were dead." Campbell told what the German experience with captured American enlisted men had been. They were known everywhere to be the most self-pitying, least fraternal, and dirtiest of all prisoners of war, said Campbell. They were incapable of concerted action on their own behalf. They despised any leader from among their own number, refused to follow or even listen to him, on the grounds that he was no better than they were, that he should stop putting on airs, and so on. Billy Pilgrim went to sleep, woke up as a widower in his empty home in Ilium. His daughter Barbara was reproaching him for writing ridiculous letters to the newspapers. "Did you hear what I said?" Barbara inquired. It was 1968 again. Of course, he had been dozing. "If you're going to act like a child, maybe we'll just have to treat you like a child." "That isn't what happens next," said Billy. "We'll see what happens next." Big Barbara now embraced herself. "It's awfully cold in here. Is the heat on?"
"The heat?"
"The furnace, the thing in the basement, the thing that makes hot air that comes out of these registers.
I don't think it's working.
Maybe not.
Aren't you cold?
I hadn't noticed.
Oh my God, you are a child. If we leave you alone here, you'll freeze to death, you'll starve to death.
And so on.
It was very exciting for her, taking his dignity away in the name of love.
Barbara called the oil burner man, and she made Billy go to bed, made him promise to stay under the electric blanket until the heat came on. She set the control of the blanket at the highest notch, which soon made Billy's bed hot enough to bake bread in.
When Barbara left, slamming the door behind her, Billy traveled in time to the zoo on Tralfamador again. A mate had just been brought to him from Earth. She was Montana Wildhack, a motion picture star. Montana was under heavy sedation. Tralfamadorians wearing gas masks brought her in, put her on Billy's yellow lounge chair, withdrew through his airlock. The vast crowd outside was delighted. All attendance records for the zoo were broken. Everybody on the planet wanted to see the Earthlings mate. Montana was naked, and so was Billy, of course. He had a tremendous wang, incidentally. You never know who'll get one. Now she fluttered her eyelids. Her lashes were like buggy whips.
Where am I? She said.
Everything is all right, said Billy gently. Please don't be afraid. Montana had been unconscious during her trip from Earth. The Tralfamadorians hadn't talked to her, hadn't shown themselves to her. The last thing she remembered was sunning herself by a swimming pool in Palm Springs, California. Montana was only 20 years old. Around her neck was a silver chain with a heart-shaped locket hanging from it, between her breasts. Now she turned her head to see the myriads of Tralfamadorians outside the dome. They were applauding her by opening and closing their little green hands quickly. Montana screamed and screamed. All the little green hands closed tight because Montana's terror was so unpleasant to see. The head zookeeper ordered a crane operator, who was standing by, to drop a navy blue canopy over the dome, thus simulating Earthling night inside. Real night came to the zoo for only one Earthling hour out of every 62. Billy switched on a floor lamp. The light from the single source threw the baroque detailing of Montana's body into sharp relief. Billy was reminded of fantastic architecture in Dresden before it was bombed. In time, Montana came to love and trust Billy Pilgrim. He did not touch her until she made it clear that she wanted him to. After she had been on Tralfamador for what would have been an Earthling week, she asked him shyly if he wouldn't sleep with her, which he did. It was heavenly. And Billy traveled in time from that delightful bed to a bed in 1968. It was his bed in Ilium, and the electric blanket was turned up high. He was drenched in sweat, remembered groggily that his daughter had put him to bed, had told him to stay there until the oil burner was repaired. Somebody was knocking on his bedroom door. Yes, said Billy.
Oil burner man.
Yes.
It's running good now. Heat's coming up.
Good.
Mouse ate through a wire from the thermostat.
I'll be darned. Billy sniffed. His hot bed smelled like a mushroom cellar. He had had a wet dream about Montana Wildhack. On the morning after that wet dream, Billy decided to go back to work in his office in the shopping plaza. Business was booming, as usual. His assistants were keeping up with it nicely. They were startled to see him. They had been told by his daughter that he might never practice again. But Billy went into his examining room briskly, asked that the first patient be sent in. So they sent him one, a 12-year-old boy who was accompanied by his widowed mother. They were strangers, new in town. Billy asked them a little about themselves, learned that the boy's father had been killed in Vietnam in the famous 5-day battle for Hill 875 near Dock To. So it goes. While he examined the boy's eyes, Billy told him matter-of-factly about his adventures on Tralfamador, assured the fatherless boy that his father was very much alive still in moments the boy would see again and again.
Isn't that comforting? Billy asked.
And somewhere in there, the boy's mother went out and told the receptionist that Billy was evidently going crazy, Billy was taken home. His daughter asked him again, "Father, father, father, what are we going to do with you?"
Chapter 6. Listen. Billy Pilgrim says he went to Dresden, Germany, on the day after his morphine night in the British compound in the center of the extermination camp for Russian prisoners of war. Billy woke up at dawn on that day in January. There were no windows in the little hospital, and the ghostly candles had gone out. So the only light came from pinprick holes in the walls and from a sketchy rectangle that outlined the imperfectly fitted door. Little Paul Lazaro, with a broken arm, snored on one bed. Edgar Derby, the high school teacher who would eventually be shot, snored on another. Billy sat up in bed. He had no idea what year it was or what planet he was on. Whatever the planet's name was, it was cold. But it wasn't the cold that had awakened Billy. It was animal magnetism which was making him shiver and itch. It gave him profound aches in his musculature, as though he had been exercising hard. The animal magnetism was coming from behind him. If Billy had had to guess as to the source, he would have said that there was a vampire bat hanging upside down on the wall behind him. Billy moved down toward the foot of his cot before turning to look at whatever it was. He didn't want the animal to drop into his face and maybe claw his eyes out or bite off his big nose. Then he turned. The source of the magnetism really did resemble a bat. It was Billy's impresario's coat with the fur collar. It was hanging from a nail. Billy now backed toward it again, looking at it over his shoulder, feeling the magnetism increase. Then he faced it, kneeling on his cot, dared to touch it here and there. He was seeking the exact source of the radiations. He found two small sources, two lumps an inch apart and hidden in the lining. One was shaped like a pea. The other was shaped like a tiny horseshoe. Billy received a message carried by the radiations. He was told not to find out what the lumps were. He was advised to be content with knowing that they could work miracles for him, provided he did not insist on learning their nature. That was all right with Billy Pilgrim. He was grateful. He was glad. Billy dozed, awakened in the prison hospital again. The sun was high. Outside were Golgotha sounds of strong men digging holes for upright timbers in hard, hard ground. Englishmen were building themselves a new latrine. They abandoned their old latrine to the Americans, and their theater, the place where the feast had been held, too. Six Englishmen staggered through a hospital with a pool table on which several mattresses were piled. They were transferring it to living quarters attached to the hospital. They were followed by an Englishman dragging his mattress and carrying a dartboard. The man with the dartboard was the blue fairy godmother who had injured little Paul Lazaro. He stopped by Lazaro's bed, asked Lazaro how he was. Lazaro told him he was going to have him killed after the war.
Oh?
You made a big mistake, said Lazaro. Anybody touches me, he better kill me, or I'm going to have him killed. The blue fairy godmother knew something about killing. He gave Lazaro a careful smile. There is still time for me to kill you, he said, if you really persuade me that it's the sensible thing to do.
Why don't you go fuck yourself?
Don't think I haven't tried, the blue fairy godmother answered. The blue fairy godmother left, amused and patronizing. When he was gone, Lazaro promised Billy and poor old Edgar Derby that he was going to have revenge, and that revenge was sweet.
It's the sweetest thing there is, said Lazaro. People fuck with me, he said, and Jesus Christ, are they ever fucking sorry. I laugh like hell. I don't care if it's a guy or a dame. If the President of the United States fucked around with me, I'd fix him good. You should have seen what I did to a dog one time.
A dog? Said Billy.
A son of a bitch bit me, so I got me some steak, and I got me the spring out of a clock. I cut that spring up in little pieces. I put points on the ends of the pieces. They were sharp as razor blades. I stuck them into the steak, way inside, and I went past where they had the dog tied up. He wanted to bite me again. I said to him, "Come on, doggy, let's be friends. Let's not be enemies anymore. I'm not mad." He believed me. He did? I threw him the steak. He swallowed it down in one big gulp. I waited around for 10 minutes.
Now Lazaro's eyes twinkled. Blood started coming out of his mouth. He started crying. He rolled on the ground, as though the knives were on the outside of him instead of on the inside of him. Then he tried to bite out his own insides. I laughed and I said to him, "You got the right idea now. Tear your own guts out, boy. That's me in there with all those knives."
So it goes.
"Anybody ever ask you what the sweetest thing in life is?" said Lazaro.
"It's revenge."
When Dresden was destroyed later on, incidentally, Lazaro did not exult. He didn't have anything against the Germans, he said. Also, he said he liked to take his enemies one at a time. He was proud of never having hurt an innocent bystander.
"Nobody ever got it from Lazaro," he said, "who didn't have it coming."
Poor old Edgar Derby, the high school teacher, got into the conversation now. He asked Lazaro if he planned to feed the blue fairy godmother clock springs and steak.
"Shit," said Lazaro.
"He's a pretty big man," said Derby, who of course was a pretty big man himself.
"Size don't mean a thing."
"You're going to shoot him?"
"I'm going to have him shot," said Lazaro. "He'll get home after the war. He'll be a big hero. The dames will be climbing all over him. He'll settle down. A couple years will go by. And then one day, there'll be a knock on his door. He'll answer the door, and there'll be a stranger out there. The stranger will ask him if he's so-and-so. When he says he is, the stranger will say, 'Paul Lazaro sent me.' And he'll pull out a gun and shoot his pecker off. The stranger will let him think a couple seconds about who Paul Lazaro is and what life's gonna be like without a pecker. Then he'll shoot him once in the guts and walk away."
So it goes.
Lazaro said that he could have anybody in the world killed for $1,000 plus traveling expenses. He had a list in his head, he said. Derby asked him who all was on the list, and Lazaro said, "Just make fucking sure you don't get on it. Just don't cross me, that's all." There was a silence, and then he added, "Don't cross my friends."
"You have friends?" Derby wanted to know.
"In the war?" said Lazaro. "Yeah, I had a friend in the war. He's dead."
So it goes. "That's too bad."
Lazaro's eyes were twinkling again. "Yeah, he was my buddy on the boxcar. His name was Roland Weary. He died in my arms."
Now he pointed to Billy with his one mobile hand.
"He died on account of this silly cocksucker here. So I promised him I'd have this silly cocksucker shot after the war."
Lazaro erased with his hand anything Billy Pilgrim might be about to say.
"Just forget about it, kid," he said. "Enjoy life while you can. Nothing's gonna happen for maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But let me give you a piece of advice. Whenever the doorbell rings, have somebody else answer the door."
Billy Pilgrim says now that this really is the way he's going to die, too. As a time traveler, he has seen his own death many times, has described it to a tape recorder. The tape is locked up with his will and some other valuables in his safe deposit box at the Ilium Merchants National Bank and Trust, he says. "I, Billy Pilgrim," the tape begins, "will die, have died, and always will die on February 13th, 1976. At the time of his death, he says, he is in Chicago to address a large crowd on the subject of flying saucers and the true nature of time. His home is still in Ilium. He has had to cross 3 international boundaries in order to reach Chicago. The United States of America has been balkanized, has been divided into 20 petty nations so that it will never again be a threat to world peace. Chicago has been hydrogen bombed by angry Chinamen." So it goes. It is all brand new. Billy is speaking before a capacity audience in a baseball park, which is covered by a geodesic dome. The flag of the country is behind him. It is a Hereford bull on a field of green. Billy predicts his own death within an hour. He laughs about it, invites the crowd to laugh with him. "It is high time I was dead," he says. "Many years ago," he said, "a certain man promised to have me killed. He is an old man now, living not far from here. He has read all the publicity associated with my appearance in your fair city. He is insane. Tonight, he will keep his promise. There are protests from the crowd. Billy Pilgrim rebukes them. If you protest, if you think that death is a terrible thing, then you have not understood a word I've said. Now he closes his speech, as he closes every speech, with these words. Farewell, hello, farewell, hello. There are police around him as he leaves the stage. They are there to protect him from the crush of popularity. No threats on his life have been made since 1945. The police offer to stay with him. They are floridly willing to stand in a circle around him all night, with their zap guns drawn. No, no, says Billy serenely. It is time for you to go home to your wives and children, and it is time for me to be dead for a little while, and then live again. At that moment, Billy's high forehead is in the crosshairs of a high-powered laser gun. It is aimed at him from the darkened press box. In the next moment, Billy Pilgrim is dead. So it goes. So Billy experiences death for a while. It is simply violet light and a hum. There isn't anybody else there. Not even Billy Pilgrim is there. Then he swings back into life again, all the way back to an hour after his life was threatened by Lazaro in 1945. He's been told to get out of his hospital bed and dress, that he is well. He and Lazaro and poor old Edgar Derby are to join their fellows in the theater. There, they will choose a leader for themselves by secret ballot in a free election. Billy and Lazaro and poor old Edgar Derby cross the prison yard to the theater now. Billy was carrying his little coat as though it were a lady's muff. It was wrapped around and around his hands. He was the central clown in an unconscious travesty of that famous oil painting, The Spirit of 76. Edgar Derby was writing letters home in his head, telling his wife that he was alive and well, that she shouldn't worry, that the war was nearly over, that he would soon be home. Lazaro was talking to himself about people he was going to have killed after the war, and rackets he was going to work, and women he was going to make fuck him, whether they wanted to or not. If he had been a dog in a city, a policeman would have shot him and sent his head to a laboratory to see if he had rabies. So it goes. As they neared the theater, they came upon an Englishman who was hacking a groove in the earth with the heel of his boot. He was marking the boundary between the American and English sections of the compound. Billy and Lazaro and Derby didn't have to ask what the line meant. It was a familiar symbol from childhood. The theater was paved with American bodies that nestled like spoons. Most of the Americans were in stupors or asleep. Their guts were fluttering, dry. "Close the fucking door," somebody said to Billy. "Were you born in a barn?" Billy closed it, took a hand from his muff, touched the stove. It was as cold as ice. The stage was still set for Cinderella. Azure curtains hung from the arches, which were shocking pink. There were golden thrones and the dummy clock, whose hands were set at midnight. Cinderella's slippers, which were airmen's boots painted silver, were capsized side by side under a golden throne. Billy and poor old Edgar Derby and Lazaro had been in the hospital when the British passed out blankets and mattresses, so they had none. They had to improvise. The only space open to them was up on the stage, and they went up there, pulled the azure curtains down, made nests. Billy, curled in his azure nest, found himself staring at Cinderella's silver boots under a throne. And then he remembered that his shoes were ruined, that he needed boots. He hated to get out of his nest, but he forced himself to do it. He crawled to the boots on all fours, sat, tried them on. The boots fit perfectly. Billy Pilgrim was Cinderella, and Cinderella was Billy Pilgrim. Somewhere in there was a lecture on personal hygiene by the head Englishman, and then a free election. At least half the Americans went on snoozing through it all. The Englishman got up on the stage, and he rapped on the arm of a throne with a swagger stick, called, "Lads, lads, lads, can I have your attention, please?" and so on. What the Englishman said about survival was this: if you stop taking pride in your appearance, you will very soon die. He said that he had seen several men die in the following way. They ceased to stand up straight, then ceased to shave or wash, then ceased to get out of bed, then ceased to talk, then died. There is this much to be said for it. It is evidently a very easy and painless way to go.
So it goes.
The Englishman said that he, when captured, had made and kept the following vows to himself: to brush his teeth twice a day, to shave once a day, to wash his face and hands before every meal and after going to the latrine, to polish his shoes once a day, to exercise for at least half an hour each morning and then move his bowels, and to look into a mirror frequently, frankly evaluating his appearance, particularly with respect to posture. Billy Pilgrim heard all this while lying in his nest. He looked not at the Englishman's face, but his ankles. "I envy you, lads," said the Englishman. Somebody laughed. Billy wondered what the joke was. "You lads are leaving this afternoon for Dresden, a beautiful city, I'm told. You won't be cooped up like us. You'll be out where the life is, and the food is certain to be more plentiful than here. If I may inject a personal note, it has been 5 years now since I have seen a tree or flower or woman or child, or a dog or a cat, or a place of entertainment, or a human being doing useful work of any kind. You needn't worry about bombs, by the way. Dresden is an open city. It is undefended and contains no war industries or troop concentrations of any importance." Somewhere in there, old Edgar Derby was elected head American. The Englishman called for nominations from the floor, and there weren't any, so he nominated Derby, praising him for his maturity and long experience in dealing with people. There were no further nominations, so the nominations were closed. "All in favor?" two or three people said. "Aye." Then poor old Derby made a speech. He thanked the Englishman for his good advice, said he meant to follow it exactly. He said he was sure that all the other Americans would do the same. He said that his primary responsibility now was to make damn well sure that everybody got home safely. "Go take a flying fuck at a rolling donut," murmured Paul Lazaro in his azure nest. "Go take a flying fuck at the moon." The temperature climbed startlingly that day. The noontime was balmy. The Germans brought soup and bread in two-wheeled carts, which were pulled by Russians. The Englishmen sent over real coffee and sugar and marmalade and cigarettes and cigars, and the doors of the theater were left open so the warmth could get in. The Americans began to feel much better. They were able to hold their food. And then it was time to go to Dresden. The Americans marched fairly stylishly out of the British compound. Billy Pilgrim again led the parade. He had silver boots now, and a muff, and a piece of azure curtain which he wore like a toga. Billy still had a beard. So did poor old Edgar Derby, who was beside him. Derby was imagining letters to home, his lips working tremulously. "Dear Margaret, we are leaving for Dresden today. Don't worry, it will never be bombed. It is an open city. There was an election at noon, and guess what?" And so on. They came to the prison railroad yard again. They had arrived on only two cars. They would depart far more comfortably on four. They saw the dead hobo again. He was frozen stiff in the weeds beside the track. He was in a fetal position, trying even in death to nestle like a spoon with others. There were no others now. He was nestling with thin air and cinders. Somebody had taken his boots. His bare feet were blue and ivory. It was all right somehow, his being dead. So it goes. The trip to Dresden was a lark. It took only 2 hours. Shriveled little bellies were full. Sunlight and mild air came in through the ventilators. There were plenty of smokes from the Englishmen. The Americans arrived in Dresden at 5 in the afternoon. The boxcar doors were opened, and the doorways framed the loveliest city that most of the Americans had ever seen. The skyline was intricate and voluptuous and enchanted and absurd. It looked like a Sunday school picture of heaven to Billy Pilgrim. Somebody behind him in the boxcar said, "Oz." That was I. That was me. The only other city I'd ever seen was Indianapolis, Indiana. Every other big city in Germany had been bombed and burned ferociously. Dresden had not suffered so much as a cracked window pane. Sirens went off every day, screamed like hell, and people went down into cellars and listened to radios there. The planes were always bound for someplace else. Leipzig, Chemnitz, Plauen, places like that. So it goes. Steam radiators still whistled cheerily in Dresden. Streetcars clanged. Telephones rang and were answered. Lights went on and off when switches were clicked. There were theaters and restaurants. There was a zoo. The principal enterprises of the city were medicine and food processing and the making of cigarettes. People were going home from work now in the late afternoon. They were tired. 8 Dresdeners crossed the steel spaghetti of the railroad yard. They were wearing new uniforms. They had been sworn into the army the day before. They were boys and men past middle age, and 2 veterans who had been shot to pieces in Russia. Their assignment was to guard 100 American prisoners of war who would work as contract labor. A grandfather and his grandson were in the squad. The grandfather was an architect. The 8 were grim as they approached the boxcars containing their wards. They knew what sick and foolish soldiers they themselves appeared to be. One of them actually had an artificial leg and carried not only a loaded rifle but a cane. Still, they were expected to earn obedience and respect from tall, cocky, murderous American infantrymen who had just come from all the killing at the front. And then they saw bearded Billy Pilgrim in his blue toga and silver shoes with his hands in a muff. He looked at least 60 years old. Next to Billy was little Paul Lazaro with a broken arm. He was fizzing with rabies. Next to Lazaro was a poor old high school teacher, Edgar Derby, mournfully pregnant with patriotism and middle age and imaginary wisdom, and so on. The 8 ridiculous Dresdeners ascertained that these 100 ridiculous creatures really were American fighting men fresh from the front. They smiled, and then they laughed. Their terror evaporated. There was nothing to be afraid of. Here were more crippled human beings, more fools like themselves. Here was light opera. So out of the gate of the railroad yard and into the streets of Dresden marched the light opera. Billy Pilgrim was the star. He led the parade. Thousands of people were on the sidewalks going home from work. They were watery and putty-colored, having eaten mostly potatoes during the past 2 years. They had expected no blessings beyond the mildness of the day. Suddenly, here was fun. Billy did not meet many of the eyes that found him so entertaining. He was enchanted by the architecture of the city. Mary Amoretti wove garlands above windows. Roguish fauns and naked nymphs peeked down at Billy from festooned cornices. Stone monkeys frisked among scrolls and seashells and bamboo. Billy, with his memories of the future, knew that the city would be smashed to smithereens and then burned in about 30 more days. He knew, too, that most of the people watching him would soon be dead. So it goes. And Billy worked his hands in his muff as he marched. His fingertips, working there in the hot darkness of the muff, wanted to know what the 2 lumps in the lining of the little impresario's coat were. The fingertips got inside the lining. They palpated the lumps, the P-shaped thing and the horseshoe-shaped thing. The parade had to halt by a busy corner. The traffic light was red. There at the corner, in the front rank of pedestrians, was a surgeon who had been operating all day. He was a civilian, but his posture was military. He had served in 2 world wars. The sight of Billy offended him, especially after he learned from the guards that Billy was an American. It seemed to him that Billy was in abominable taste. Suppose that Billy had gone to a lot of silly trouble to costume himself just so. The surgeon spoke English, and he said to Billy, "I take it you find the war a very comical thing." Billy looked at him vaguely. Billy had lost track momentarily of where he was or how he had gotten there. He had no idea that people thought he was clowning. It was fate, of course, which had costumed him. Fate and a feeble will to survive. "Did you expect us to laugh?" the surgeon asked him. The surgeon was demanding some sort of satisfaction. Billy was mystified. Billy wanted to be friendly, to help if he could, but his resources were meager. His fingers now held the two objects from the lining of the coat. Billy decided to show the surgeon what they were.
"You thought we would enjoy being mocked?" the surgeon said. "And do you feel proud to represent America as you do?"
Billy withdrew a hand from his muff, held it under the surgeon's nose. On his palm rested a 2-carat diamond and a partial denture. The denture was an obscene little artifact, silver and pearl and tangerine. Billy smiled. The parade pranced, staggered, and reeled to the gate of the Dresden slaughterhouse, and then it went inside. The slaughterhouse wasn't a busy place anymore. Almost all the hooved animals in Germany had been killed and eaten and excreted by human beings, mostly soldiers. So it goes. The Americans were taken to the 5th building inside the gate. It was a 1-story cement block cube with sliding doors in front and back. It had been built as a shelter for pigs about to be butchered. Now it was going to serve as a home away from home for 100 American prisoners of war. There were bunks in there, and 2 pot-bellied stoves, and a water tap. Behind it was a latrine, which was a 1-rail fence with buckets under it. There was a big number over the door of the building. The number was 5. Before the Americans could go inside, their only English-speaking guard told them to memorize their simple address, in case they got lost in the big city. Their address was this, Schlachthof 5. Schlachthof meant slaughterhouse. 5 was good old 5.
Chapter 7. Billy Pilgrim got onto a chartered airplane in Ilium 25 years after that. He knew it was going to crash, but he didn't want to make a fool of himself by saying so. It was supposed to carry Billy and 28 other optometrists to a convention in Montreal. His wife, Valencia, was outside, and his father-in-law, Lionel Merble, was strapped to the seat beside him. Lionel Merble was a machine. Tralfamadorians, of course, say that every creature and plant in the universe is a machine. It amuses them that so many Earthlings are offended by the idea of being machines. Outside the plane, the machine named Valencia Merble Pilgrim was eating a Peter Paul Mound bar and waving bye-bye. The plane took off without incident. The moment was structured that way. There was a barbershop quartet on board. They were optometrists, too. They called themselves the Febs, which was an acronym for 4-eyed bastards. When the plane was safely aloft, the machine that was Billy's father-in-law asked the quartet to sing his favorite song. They knew what song he meant, and they sang it, and it went like this. In my prison cell I sit, with my britches full of shit, and my balls are bouncing gently on the floor. And I see the bloody snag when she bit me in the bag. Oh, I'll never fuck a Polack anymore. Billy's father-in-law laughed and laughed at that, and he begged the quartet to sing the other Polish song he liked so much. So they sang a song from the Pennsylvania coal mines that began, Me and Mike, we work in mine. Holy shit, we have good time. Once a week, we get our pay. Holy shit, no work next day. Speaking of people from Poland, Billy Pilgrim accidentally saw a Pole hanged in public about 3 days after Billy got to Dresden. Billy just happened to be walking to work with some others shortly after sunrise, and they came to a gallows and a small crowd in front of a soccer stadium. The Pole was a farm laborer who was being hanged for having had sexual intercourse with a German woman. So it goes. Billy, knowing the plane was going to crash pretty soon, closed his eyes, traveled in time back to 1944. He was back in the forest in Luxembourg again, with the 3 musketeers. Roland Weary was shaking him, bonking his head against the tree. You guys go on without me, said Billy Pilgrim. The barbershop quartet on the airplane was singing, Wait till the sun shines, Nelly, when the plane smacked into the top of Sugar Bush Mountain in Vermont. Everybody was killed but Billy and the co-pilot. So it goes. The people who first got to the crash scene were young Austrian ski instructors from the famous ski resort below. They spoke to each other in German as they went from body to body.
They wore black wind masks with two holes for their eyes and a red topknot. They looked like gollywogs, like white people pretending to be black for the laughs they could get. Billy had a fractured skull, but he was still conscious. He didn't know where he was. His lips were working, and one of the gollywogs put his ear close to them to hear what might be his dying words. Billy thought the gollywog had something to do with World War II, and he whispered to him his address.
Schlachthof Fünf.
Billy was brought down Sugarbush Mountain on a toboggan. The gollywogs controlled it with ropes and yodeled melodiously for right of way. Near the bottom, the trails swooped around the pylons of a chairlift. Billy looked up at all the young people in bright elastic clothing and enormous boots and goggles, bombed out of their skulls with snow, swinging through the sky in yellow chairs. He supposed that they were part of an amazing new phase of World War II. It was all right with him. Everything was pretty much all right with Billy. He was taken to a small private hospital. A famous brain surgeon came up from Boston and operated on him for 3 hours. Billy was unconscious for 2 days after that, and he dreamed millions of things, some of them true. The true things were time travel. One of the true things was his first evening in the slaughterhouse. He and poor old Edgar Derby were pushing an empty two-wheeled cart down a dirt lane between empty pens for animals. They were going to a communal kitchen for supper for all. They were guarded by a 16-year-old German named Werner Gluck. The axles of the cart were greased with the fat of dead animals. So it goes. The sun had just gone down, and its afterglow was backlighting the city, which formed low cliffs around the bucolic void to the idle stockyards. The city was blacked out because bombers might come, so Billy didn't get to see Dresden do one of the most cheerful things a city is capable of doing when the sun goes down, which is to wink its lights on, one by one. There was a broad river to reflect those lights, which would have made their nighttime winkings very pretty indeed. It was the Elbe. Werner Gluck, the young guard, was a Dresden boy. He had never been in the slaughterhouse before, so he wasn't sure where the kitchen was. He was tall and weak, like Billy. Might have been a younger brother of his. They were, in fact, distant cousins, something they never found out. Gluck was armed with an incredibly heavy musket, a single-shot museum piece with an octagonal barrel and a smooth bore. He had fixed his bayonet. It was like a long knitting needle. It had no blood gutters. Gluck led the way to a building that he thought might contain the kitchen, and he opened the sliding door in its side. There wasn't a kitchen in there, though. There was a dressing room adjacent to a communal shower, and there was a lot of steam. In the steam were about 30 teenage girls with no clothes on. They were German refugees from Breslau, which had been tremendously bombed. They had just arrived in Dresden, too. Dresden was jammed with refugees. There those girls were with all their private parts bare for anybody to see. And there in the doorway were Gluck and Derby and Pilgrim, the childish soldier and the poor old high school teacher and the clown in his toga and silver shoes, staring. The girls screamed. They covered themselves with their hands and turned their backs and so on and made themselves utterly beautiful. Werner Gluck, who had never seen a naked woman before, closed the door. Billy had never seen one either. It was nothing new to Derby. When the three fools found the communal kitchen, whose main job was to make lunch for workers in the slaughterhouse, everybody had gone home but one woman who had been waiting for them impatiently. She was a war widow. So it goes. She had her hat and coat on. She wanted to go home too, even though there wasn't anybody there. Her white gloves were laid out side by side on the zinc countertop. She had two big cans of soup for the Americans. It was simmering over low fires on the gas range. She had stacks of loaves of black bread, too. She asked Gluck if he wasn't awfully young to be in the army. He admitted that he was. She asked Edgar Derby if he wasn't awfully old to be in the army. He said he was. She asked Billy Pilgrim what he was supposed to be. Billy said he didn't know. He was just trying to keep warm. "All the real soldiers are dead," she said. It was true. So it goes. Another true thing that Billy saw while he was unconscious in Vermont was the work that he and the others had to do in Dresden during the month before the city was destroyed. They washed windows and swept floors and cleaned lavatories and put jars into boxes and sealed cardboard boxes in a factory that made malt syrup. The syrup was enriched with vitamins and minerals. The syrup was for pregnant women. The syrup tasted like thin honey laced with hickory smoke, and everybody who worked in the factory secretly spooned it all day long. They weren't pregnant, but they needed vitamins and minerals, too. Billy didn't spoon syrup on his first day at work, but lots of other Americans did. Billy spooned it on his second day. There were spoons hidden all over the factory, on rafters, in drawers, behind radiators, and so on. They had been hidden in haste by persons who had been spooning syrup, who had heard somebody else coming. Spooning was a crime. On his second day, Billy was cleaning behind a radiator, and he found a spoon. To his back was a vat of syrup that was cooling. The only other person who could see Billy and his spoon was poor old Edgar Derby, who was washing a window outside. The spoon was a tablespoon. Billy thrust it into the vat, turned it around and around, making a gooey lollipop. He thrust it into his mouth. A moment went by, and then every cell in Billy's body shook him with ravenous gratitude and applause. There were diffident raps on the factory window. Derby was out there, having seen all. He wanted some syrup, too. So Billy made a lollipop for him. He opened the window. He stuck the lollipop into poor old Derby's gaping mouth. A moment passed, and then Derby burst into tears. Billy closed the window and hid the sticky spoon. Somebody was coming. Chapter 8. The Americans in the slaughterhouse had a very interesting visitor 2 days before Dresden was destroyed. He was Howard W. Campbell, Jr., an American who had become a Nazi. Campbell was the one who had written the monograph about the shabby behavior of American prisoners of war. He wasn't doing more research about prisoners now. He'd come to the slaughterhouse to recruit men for a German military unit called the Free American Corps. Campbell was the inventor and commander of the unit, which was supposed to fight only on the Russian front. Campbell was an ordinary-looking man, but he was extravagantly costumed in a uniform of his own design. He wore a white 10-gallon hat and black cowboy boots decorated with swastikas and stars. He was sheathed in a blue body stocking, which had yellow stripes running from his armpits to his ankles. His shoulder patch was a silhouette of Abraham Lincoln's profile on a field of pale green. He had a broad armband, which was red, with a blue swastika in a circle of white. He was explaining this armband now in the cement block hog barn. Billy Pilgrim had a boiling case of heartburn, since he had been spooning malt syrup all day long at work. The heartburn brought tears to his eyes, so that his image of Campbell was distorted by jiggling lenses of salt water. "Blue is for the American sky," Campbell was saying. "White is for the race that pioneered the continent, drained the swamps, and cleared the forests, and built the roads and bridges. Red is for the blood of American patriots, which was shed so gladly in years gone by." Campbell's audience was sleepy. It had worked hard at the syrup factory, and then it had marched a long way home in the cold. It was skinny and hollow-eyed. Its skins were beginning to blossom with small sores. So were its mouths and throats and intestines. The malt syrup it spooned at the factory contained only a few of the vitamins and minerals every earthling needs. Campbell offered the Americans food now, steaks and mashed potatoes and gravy and mince pie, if they would join the Free American Corps. "Once the Russians are defeated," he went on, "you will be repatriated through Switzerland." There was no response. "You're going to have to fight the communists sooner or later," said Campbell. "Why not get it over with now?" And then it developed that Campbell was not going to go unanswered after all. Poor old Derby, the doomed high school teacher, lumbered to his feet for what was probably the finest moment in his life. There are almost no characters in this story, and almost no dramatic confrontations, because most of the people in it are so sick, and so much the listless playthings of enormous forces.
One of the main effects of war, after all, is that people are discouraged from being characters. But old Derby was a character now. His stance was that of a punch-drunk fighter. His head was down. His fists were out front, waiting for information and battle plan. Derby raised his head, called Campbell a snake. He corrected that. He said that snakes couldn't help being snakes, and that Campbell, who could help being what he was something much lower than a snake, or a rat, or even a blood-filled tick. Campbell smiled. Derby spoke movingly of the American form of government, with freedom and justice and opportunities and fair play for all. He said there wasn't a man there who wouldn't gladly die for those ideals. He spoke of the brotherhood between the American and the Russian people, and how those two nations were going to crush the disease of Nazism, which wanted to infect the whole world. The air raid sirens of Dresden howled mournfully. The Americans and their guards and Campbell took shelter in an echoing meat locker, which was hollowed in living rock under the slaughterhouse. There was an iron staircase with iron doors at the top and bottom. Down in the locker were a few cattle and sheep and pigs and horses hanging from iron hooks. So it goes. The locker had empty hooks for thousands more. It was naturally cool. There was no refrigeration. There was candlelight. The locker was whitewashed and smelled of carbolic acid. There were benches along a wall. The Americans went to these, brushing away flakes of whitewash before they sat down. Howard W. Campbell, Jr. remained standing like the guards. He talked to the guards in excellent German. He had written many popular German plays and poems in his time, and had married a famous German actress named Raisie North. She was dead now, had been killed while entertaining troops in the Crimea. So it goes. Nothing happened that night. It was the next night that about 130,000 people in Dresden would die. So it goes. Billy dozed in the meat locker. He found himself engaged again, word for word, gesture for gesture, in the argument with his daughter with which this tale began. "Father," she said, "what are we going to do with you?" And so on. "You know who I could just kill?" she asked. "Who could you kill?" said Billy. "That Kilgore Trout." Kilgore Trout was and is a science fiction writer, of course. Billy had not only read dozens of books by Trout, he had also become Trout's friend, to the extent that anyone can become a friend of Trout, who was a bitter man. Trout lives in a rented basement in Ilium, about 2 miles from Billy's nice white home. He himself has no idea how many novels he has written, possibly 75 of the things. Not one of them has made money, so Trout keeps body and soul together as a circulation man for the Ilium Gazette, manages newspaper delivery boys, bullies and flatters and cheats little kids. Billy met him for the first time in 1964. Billy drove his Cadillac down a back alley in Ilium, and he found his way blocked by dozens of boys and their bicycles. A meeting was in progress. The boys were harangued by a man in a full beard. He was cowardly and dangerous and obviously very good at his job. Trout was 62 years old back then. He was telling the kids to get off their dead butts and get their daily customers to subscribe to the fucking Sunday edition too. He said that whoever sold the most Sunday subscriptions during the next 2 months would get a free trip for himself and his parents to Martha's fucking vineyard for a week, all expenses paid, and so on. One of the newspaper boys was actually a newspaper girl. She was electrified. Trout's paranoid face was terribly familiar to Billy, who had seen it on the jackets of so many books. But coming upon that face suddenly in a hometown alley, Billy could not guess why the face was familiar. Billy thought maybe he had known this cracked messiah in Dresden somewhere. Trout certainly looked like a prisoner of war. And then the newspaper girl held up her hand. "Mr. Trout," she said, "if I win, can I take my sister too?" "Hell no," said Kilgore Trout. "You think money grows on trees?" Trout, incidentally, had written a book about a money tree. It had $20 bills for leaves. Its flowers were government bonds. Its fruit was diamonds. It attracted human beings who killed each other around the roots and made very good fertilizer. So it goes.
Billy Pilgrim parked his Cadillac in the alley and waited for the meeting to end. When the meeting broke up, there was still one boy Trout had to deal with. The boy wanted to quit because the work was so hard and the hours were so long and the pay was so small. Trout was concerned because if the boy really quit, Trout would have to deliver the boy's root himself until he could find another sucker.
"What are you?" Trout asked the boy scornfully. "Some kind of gutless wonder?"
This, too, was the title of a book by Trout, The Gutless Wonder. It was about a robot who had bad breath, who became popular after his halitosis was cured. But what made the story remarkable, since it was written in 1932, was that it predicted the widespread use of burning jellied gasoline on human beings. It was dropped on them from airplanes. Robots did the dropping. They had no conscience and no circuits which would allow them to imagine what was happening to the people on the ground. Trout's leading robot looked like a human being and could talk and dance and so on and go out with girls. And nobody held it against him that he dropped jellied gasoline on people. But they found his halitosis unforgivable. But then he cleared that up, and he was welcomed to the human race. Trout lost his argument with the boy who wanted to quit. He told the boy about all the millionaires who had carried newspapers as boys, and the boy replied, "Yeah, but I bet they quit after a week. It's such a royal screwing." And the boy left his full newspaper bag at Trout's feet, with the customer book on top. It was up to Trout to deliver these papers. He didn't have a car. He didn't even have a bicycle, and he was scared to death of dogs. Somewhere a big dog barked. As Trout lugubriously slung the bag from his shoulder, Billy Pilgrim approached him.
"Mr. Trout?"
"Yes."
"Are you Kilgore Trout?"
"Yes." Trout supposed that Billy had some complaint about the way his newspapers were being delivered. He did not think of himself as a writer, for the simple reason that the world had never allowed him to think of himself in this way.
The writer," said Billy.
"The what?" Billy was certain that he had made a mistake.
"There's a writer named Kilgore Trout."
"There is?" Trout looked foolish and dazed.
"You never heard of him?"
Trout shook his head. Nobody ever did." Billy helped Trout deliver his papers, driving him from house to house in the Cadillac. Billy was the responsible one, finding the houses, checking them off. Trout's mind was blown. He had never met a fan before, and Billy was such an avid fan. Trout told him that he had never seen a book of his advertised, reviewed, or on sale. "All these years," he said, "I've been opening the window and making love to the world."
"You must surely have gotten letters," said Billy. "I felt like writing you letters many times."
Trout held up a single finger.
"One." "Was it enthusiastic?"
"It was insane. The writer said I should be president of the world." It turned out that the person who had written this letter was Elliot Rosewater, Billy's friend in the veterans' hospital near Lake Placid. Billy told Trout about Rosewater.
"My God, I thought he was about 14 years old," said Trout.
"A full-grown man, a captain in the war."
"He writes like a 14-year-old, said Kilgore Trout.
Billy invited Trout to his 18th wedding anniversary, which was only 2 days hence. Now the party was in progress. Trout was in Billy's dining room gobbling canapes. He was talking with a mouthful of Philadelphia cream cheese and salmon roe to an optometrist's wife. Everybody at the party was associated with optometry in some way, except Trout, and he alone was without glasses. He was making a great hit. Everybody was thrilled to have a real author at the party, even though they had never read his books. Trout was talking to a Maggie White, who had given up being a dental assistant to become a homemaker for an optometrist. She was very pretty. The last book she had read was Ivanhoe. Billy Pilgrim stood nearby listening. He was palpating something in his pocket. It was a present he was about to give his wife, a white satin box containing a star sapphire cocktail ring. The ring was worth $800. The adulation that Trout was receiving, mindless and illiterate as it was, affected Trout like marijuana. He was happy and loud and impudent. "I'm afraid I don't read as much as I ought to," said Maggie.
We're all afraid of something, Trout replied. I'm afraid of cancer and rats and Doberman pinchers.
I should know, but I don't, so I have to ask, said Maggie. What's the most famous thing you ever wrote?
It was about a funeral for a great French chef.
That sounds interesting.
All the great chefs in the world are there. It's a beautiful ceremony. Trout was making this up as he went along. Just before the casket is closed, the mourners sprinkle parsley and paprika on the deceased.
So it goes. Did that really happen? Said Maggie White. She was a dull person, but a sensational invitation to make babies. Men looked at her and wanted to fill her up with babies right away. She hadn't had even one baby yet. She used birth control.
Of course it happened, Trout told her. If I wrote something that hadn't really happened and I tried to sell it, I could go to jail. That's fraud.
Maggie believed him. I'd never thought about that before.
Think about it now.
It's like advertising. You have to tell the truth in advertising or you get in trouble.
Exactly. The same body of law applies.
Do you think you might put us in a book sometime?
I put everything that happens to me in books.
I guess I better be careful what I say.
That's right. And I'm not the only one who's listening. God is listening, too. And on Judgment Day, he's going to tell you all the things you said and did. If it turns out they're bad things instead of good things, that's too bad for you, because you'll burn forever and ever. The burning never stops hurting.
Poor Maggie turned gray. She believed that, too, and was petrified.
Kilgore Trout laughed uproariously. A salmon egg flew out of his mouth and landed in Maggie's cleavage. Now an optometrist called for attention. He proposed a toast to Billy and Valencia, whose anniversary it was. According to plan, the barbershop quartet of optometrists, the Febs, sang while people drank, and Billy and Valencia put their arms around each other, just glowed. Everybody's eyes were shining. The song was, "That Old Gang of Mine."
Gee, that song went, "But I'd give the world to see that old gang of mine," and so on.
A little later it said, "So long forever, old fellows and gals. So long forever, old sweethearts and pals. God bless 'em," and so on.